This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
A key city council committee convened for an update on how the Johnson administration is implementing the budget.
He didn't veto it. He basically said, okay, I'm fine with it. But then he started to poo-poo that budget.
Federal prosecutors were dropping the conspiracy charge against the so-called Broadview 6.
We were protesting ICE, and then we were brought forward with this really extraordinary charge.
Students and workers this morning joined forces to support striking graduate employees at the University of Illinois Chicago.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. And it's our weekly news recap. Conspiracy charges have been dropped against the so-called Broadview 6 defendants. UIC graduate student workers strike for higher pay. In Springfield, the Illinois legislature is finalizing its game plan to keep the Chicago Bears in Illinois. Plus, two police officers were shot at Chicago's Swedish Hospital on the north side.
Chicago officer John Bartholomew was killed in Saturday's shooting, and another officer remains in critical condition.
We give the judges the ability to say, no, you're not going to get bail. You are going to stay in jail.
Can Springfield get the Bears mega projects bill across the finish line?
If they are going to move away from Soldier Field, I hope that they move to Northwest Indiana.
Expanding affordable housing.
Illinois is short about 142,000 housing units.
We don't believe that it's been thought through.
Is there a place for multifamily housing? Sure. Where to put it and how do you fit that into the design of your town is the open question.
Now, before we get into the conversation, Sun-Times reporter Mary Norkel, who is one of our panelists today, joins me now in the studio to talk about the changes coming to a popular uptown bar. Hey, Mary, tell us what's going on.
Hello. So many might know the Holiday Club. It's up in Uptown, kind of Rat Pack themed bar. They're known for their 80s nights, their theme nights, and their backroom dance floor.
Oh, yeah.
And they announced, there's been lots of kind of lead up to this, and they announced that their last day open will be on May 17th. So
they are
closing. Yes. It's kind of got a cult following. People are very upset and kind of losing this pillar of the community.
They are hoping to reopen the bar in a new location, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I talked to the owner and he said that's the goal, but he's looking around and trying to find something affordable. And that's really difficult right now.
That's going to be tough in this day and age.
Right. And I think people would really want to see it remain in a similar area. And that might be tough too. So we'll see what happens. They're closing to make way for new apartments, which is another thing that some people are kind of upset about, saying we don't really want more luxury apartments. We want more places where people gather and have a good time and socialize.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that uproar you mentioned, people are going to social media, aren't they?
They sure are. On the Instagram post that the bar posted announcing its last day, the comments were, I mean, people really felt strongly about this.
One person, anything you can share on air?
I sure can. One person, I hope jokingly, threatened to chain themselves to the door.
Oh, my goodness.
But there were also, you know, people that said, I met my girlfriend there. Our first date was there. Like, this was like a place that's important to a lot of people, and that's very clear.
Oh, my goodness. The drama.
I know, right?
Well, I hope they figure it out soon and, you know,
and
get
hopefully
to,
that person is not chained to the door.
Hope that person's not chained to the door, and I hope that the folks at the Holiday Club get to find a new spot.
Right. We'll see what happens.
All right. Glad you could stop by to fill us in, Mary. Thanks for doing that. Let's dive in because there's so much more news to get to. Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Alex Nitkin, government finance and accountability reporter with the Illinois Answers Project at the Better Government Association, and Mac Lederman, who's a Block Club Chicago reporter. Now, in this episode of the pod, we start the conversation in Springfield, where it's been a busy week for lawmakers. Alex gave us the latest on the game plan to keep the Bears in Illinois. Here he is.
The Illinois House passed a bill that would create new rules for any, not just necessarily the Bears, but any developer over a certain threshold trying to propose a really big project to essentially allow them to directly negotiate with local governments how much they pay in property taxes. And this is sort of their attempt to thread the needle of trying to offer the Bears something that would actually make it attractive enough for them to go ahead and build their stadium and surrounding complex on the giant parcel that they have already bought, by the way, years ago in Arlington Heights, but also not give things away, not starve local school districts of property tax money. And so it's a very delicate sort of political dance. The House passed this bill that would try to thread that needle, and then the Bears came out and said, okay, we sort of like this, but we want a little bit more. And now it's just this sort of game of chicken between the state of Illinois and the state of Indiana, just waiting to see who the Bears give that red rose to, you know? And they're getting pressure from the NFL to be like, it's time. You got to make a decision already.
Yeah, this game of chicken. I like the way you put it. And I'm curious what you think, Mac, because could the Bears just go to Indiana and it not be a big deal? I'm thinking of the East Coast where the New York Jets and the Giants play in New Jersey, actually. I mean, same idea, no?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Jersey myself. I've been to a few Jets and Giants games. And at this point, it's just, you don't even really think about it. You're right across the highway there, over there in Jersey. They still feel like the New York Giants and the New York Jets in a way. And I think the NFL knows that, and they're playing into that. So I'd say the plan for him in Indiana is more of a hedge, but it's not a bluff at this point either. We had Roger Goodell and Bears Brass go over there and tour the facilities. It's really not that far from Southside Chicagoans, I think, would be a little bit happier maybe in Indiana than commuting all the way up north. So
that's true.
And the tax breaks, they're all built in already, unlike in Illinois. Indiana is very ready to accept and welcome the Bears with open arms and roll out the red carpet and pay for it too. Yeah. So there's a world in which I can see it. I still think the Arlington Heights campus has been on their radar for such a long time. That's the real crown jewel of this situation, but the alternative is definitely on the table, and it's pushing this forward.
For sure. I was even thinking of Washington. The Commanders, they play in Maryland.
I mean, what's interesting is that Hammond is even closer to the city of Chicago than Arlington Heights is, you know? And also, considering what the Indiana legislature passed, it's not just tax breaks. It's a straight-up giveaway of billions of dollars. They want to raise taxes on their own residents to actually fund the construction and operation of that stadium. And so the fact that the Bears have not already just gone with that, I think, means that they are still really seriously considering, you know, they want to move to Arlington Heights.
Last week, the Illinois House passed a constitutional amendment on redistricting. But on Wednesday, the Senate decided not to move forward with that amendment. Fill us in, Mary.
Yes. So with this one, there's kind of a lot going on at the state and federal level that coincide. They affect each other. And the result is kind of, we're going to wait and see what happens.
Okay.
So the Illinois House passed that constitutional amendment that would essentially is directed toward directing lawmakers to consider race in congressional maps and boundaries. And that was passed. It was sent to the Senate. And then in the interim, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a part of a Louisiana law that was similar and basically called into question any sort of redistricting that has to do with race, has to do with boundaries, things like that. And so Senate said, we're going to pause on considering that and see how this all plays out, because obviously when the Supreme Court rules on something, it sets a precedent for state laws, local laws, anything like that. So Senate President Don Harmon essentially said, it's more important that we do this right than we do this quickly. And they're pausing for now. So we'll see what happens.
Well, Monday on In the Loop, we're going to explore local reactions and potential local impact of the Supreme Court's ruling on voting rights, what it means for the upcoming election, and what it means for you. Monday morning at 9 right here on WBEZ. So I want to stick with elections for another moment here, Mac. You talked to a Libertarian candidate. Now, they had some thoughts and theories about Democrats on the ballot in Cook County. What is this all about?
Yeah, this is a fun one. So yesterday I went to the Cook County ballot drawing, which determines the order on ballots in the midterm elections here in Chicago. The order of the party. So you see Republicans first, Democrats first, Libertarians first. There's a general thinking, right? If your name's on top of the ballot, you're likely to pick up a few more votes. So those parties were jockeying for a position. This is a time-honored process in which the county clerk draws cards from a fishbowl to pick the order. But Democrats had actually won the last four straight consecutive ballot positionings, the top spot, and that drew several libertarian candidates who sent out an email blast, everyone in the local press, encouraging them to come and be like, hey, like, what's really going on here? I was the only person to show up along with three local libertarians, and sure enough, the Republicans actually won the top spot, beating the Democratic streak. Mm. If the Democrats had won, that the fifth consecutive time would have been less than a 1% chance of that happening.
Oh, wow.
In a place where, you know, Democrats dominate elections. So
interesting.
The streak has been broken. I think the libertarians have laid their case to rest for now.
Alex, another item lawmakers have been debating in Springfield is the governor's affordable housing plan. So tell us more about Pritzker's build bills.
Yes, BUILD stand for Building Up Illinois.
LD.
Oh, man, I set myself up for failure on that one. I mean, it's actually, this was basically his big initiative that he rolled out this year with the State of the State. Sort of every year he wants to put most of his energy around one thing. And this really is, it's not just one bill. It is a cluster. It's a series of about a half a dozen bills that all aim to boost the construction of more housing, affordable housing, market rate housing, all kinds of housing, all across the state. Basically, the theory behind this is that there is a growing academic and policy consensus across the state and across mm-hmm. the country that there just are not enough homes in the state, that supply is just not keeping up with demand. And that is a huge reason for the affordable crisis, the affordable housing crisis that we're seeing. I saw, and this is at the rental level, the for sale level, someone shared recently a screenshot of a apartment listing in Logan Square where instead of a rental listing, you can enter a bid for how much you would pay in rent. And this
I've
is basically,
oh, yes.
This is the phenomenon that we're talking about. And so through a series of bills that essentially are trying to make municipalities all across the state sort of relax what's called exclusionary zoning, saying we don't want any more housing built here, to actually go to every single community in the state and say, no, you have to do something. You have to allow small apartment buildings in more places. You have to allow accessory dwelling units, which we've talked about here, coach houses.
Yeah.
You have to limit the amount of parking that you're requiring.
And you got a lot of mayors and municipality officials from around the state opposing the governor's plan.
That's right. I mean, we heard you played a clip of it at the top, basically saying, yes, we need more multifamily housing, but not where I live, essentially. You've heard the acronym like NIMBY, not in my backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really, it's that collective action problem, right? Of everyone saying like, sure, we want to see more housing, but not in South Barrington, not in Glencoe, you know, not in Wheeling. And so what that ends up creating is a segregated state and many, many communities all across the state where if you don't have enough money, you simply cannot live in that town, period.
And quickly tell us about this other bill related to this, Alex, that passed the House and it's now pending in the Senate. I'm talking about the Affordable Housing Planning and Appeals Act.
Yeah, this is really interesting. This is something that I hadn't known a whole lot about. I think it's sort of flown into the radar. This is something that is not officially part of the governor's build plan, but it's sort of a parallel to it. This is an existing law, the Affordable Housing Planning and Appeals Act, that requires any municipality in the state, of which there are, I think, about 40 right now, that are deemed to not have any affordable housing, to submit a plan to the state to say, here's how we're going to build more housing. There are a lot of municipalities that haven't even bothered to submit anything. Basically, it's toothless. It's sort of like inviting towns to say, like, if we wanted to build more affordable housing, here's how we do it. And it hasn't really actually compelled them.
Oh, okay.
And so this would add some more teeth to that. And so it's just one more element of this effort to say, no, we're not going to tell you how you have to build more housing, but you can't shirk that responsibility. Yeah. You can't say we're not going to build at all.
Well, they've got until May 31st. What is the likelihood, you think, of it passing in the Senate?
You know, it's hard to say, but I think that it has a lot of momentum. It has a lot of accumulated a whole lot of co-sponsors, and I think a really big piece in its favor is that they amended it so that it will not go into effect for a couple of years. This sort of goes in 5-year cycles, and mm-hmm. they won't go into effect until the next 5-year cycle. That quieted a lot of the critics, and so it seems like it has some pretty strong momentum at this point. But who's to say what'll happen?
Mary, now a local judge is coming under criticism for releasing a felon alleged to have shot two police officers, one fatally, at a Swedish hospital in Chicago. So tell us, what exactly happened last weekend?
Yes, so this was last Saturday, and as you said, two police were
police officers were shot at Swedish Hospital after a man was arrested earlier that day and was taken to Swedish. Prosecutors said he pulled a gun out from a blanket, shot both of them. One has died, as you said, and one is in critical condition. So that is kind of the nuts and bolts, though there was a lot of backstory that I'm sure we'll get to as well.
Yeah, and Swedish Hospital, for folks who don't know, it's on the north side of the city. Mm-hmm. And as part of this, you know, the police officer who was killed, his name's John Bartholomew. His funeral, we just got an announcement of when that will be held. It'll be next Friday in Edgewater. Give us the status right now of the other officer.
So the other officer was critical immediately and has slowly started to show some signs of improvement, according to the Fraternal Order of Police President John Catanzara. He's, you know, showing a little bit of an on-ramp toward recovery, they think. But, you know, I don't know that he's totally out of the woods yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, Catanzara himself was saying he's fighting for his life. This is, you know, this is really bad, really critical. He was shot in the face, by the way.
Yeah. Catanzara says he was, quote, breathing on his own for a little while and was showing, quote, some positive physical reactions and to some conversation that was happening around him. So that's good to hear. Mm-hmm. We'll keep an eye, of course. I want to get the backstory, though, of this suspect that you talk about, Mary.
Yes.
It's a 26-year-old. How he ended up being released on home monitoring after all this?
Not after all this. So
this was before.
He was, yes, at the time of the shooting, he was released on home monitoring for charges of possessing a stolen vehicle and battering a correctional officer. And before that, he was also released on home monitoring on carjacking charges also. So this was the second time. And he started missing court dates. He had turned off his monitoring. And then a couple weeks later, this is what happened. So lots of critics coming out of the woodwork. Criticizing the judge, as you said, criticizing the cashless bail system.
Yeah.
That's relatively recent. Criticizing the electronic monitoring system. There's a lot of big questions here about systems at play. And of course, you know, the suspect and his status himself, many questions here.
One of those critics is our governor, Pritzker. Let's hear what he had to say.
As you've seen, in most of the cases where Republicans have complained about the safety, it's actually been the bad decision by an elected judge in Illinois or no hearing at all because the prosecutor didn't bring it to the judge. And that has been a reason why somebody gets let out. A judge can make this decision. A judge should have made the decision to keep that person in jail.
So clearly the governor thinks the judge made a mistake. Tell us more about what critics are saying about Illinois' Safety Act. This was what, back in 2023, it ended cash bail.
Yes, and that was a huge moment for the system, for the state. It's, you know, and we've continued to see some fallout from that and some kind of, you know, consequences, positive, negative, in between of that in the years since. So now with this most recent case, Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke has called the electronic monitoring system broken, and other critics are kind of, as I said, going off this cashless bail, mm-hmm. like Comptroller Susana Mendoza, who is basically saying that it's a symptom of the system failing and not working for people.
So, Mac, the story actually doesn't end there, right? There are also issues around the gun that the alleged suspect was using.
Yeah, a lot of questions around this situation still unanswered, and I think it's really captured the city's attention. But the biggest question, at least for me, is where did this gun come from, Sasha, and how did it end up inside a hospital? And we still have very few answers for that, but we're beginning to piece it together through court documents.
Mm-hmm.
We heard from prosecutors and county court saying that the gun used to kill the police officer was also used in a robbery by the suspect prior to his visit to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
We're also hearing that this gun has come from a woman named Olivia Burgos, who's being charged in federal court for lying on documents seeking the acquisition of a firearm. She claimed that she, you know, bought this gun and actually admitted to giving it to an unknown person who is implied to be the suspect here, Alfonso Talley. Mm-hmm. So lying on documents, she also admitted to having a fentanyl addiction and daily use problems and picking up this gun for her boyfriend, the unidentified individual believed to be Talley, from a gun store in Indiana. So more to learn about where this gun came from and how it ended up in the hands of someone inside a hospital after being a wanted.
It's a straw purchaser is what they call it. Mm-hmm.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Connection is the greatest strength in the fight against suicide. Together, we can encourage those who are struggling to seek help and to know they're not alone. For free resources or to learn how you can get involved in their mission, visit afsp.org.
A new poll shows Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson has some work to do if he wants to win a second term. Now, with less than a year until Chicago's next mayoral election, a Suffolk University Chicago Tribune poll showed more Chicagoans, 44%, view the mayor unfavorably. 34% said they viewed him favorably. I wanted to get all their thoughts on how concerned Mayor Johnson should be about those low approval ratings. Alex went first.
I mean, I think it's going to be an uphill battle for sure to get reelected. He hasn't officially announced whether he's going to run for reelection.
Yeah, we're still waiting for that, aren't we?
It's sort of getting to that time. And it's funny, I remember this exact point. We were here 4 years ago. Like, is Mayor Lightfoot going to run again? He definitely seems like he's positioning himself. He's sort of half-joked for a long time about how he wants to be mayor for five terms. and it seems sort of inevitable. But yeah, it's he's got a whole lot of unpopular opinion lined up against him. Maybe this poll was not as dire as some of the ones that we've seen previously, showing him at like 6% approval, you know, wild numbers like that. Mac and I were talking about her earlier, maybe the opposition to Midway Blitz and President Trump has sort of helped bolster his approval ratings a little bit, but it's definitely still, he has a lot of folks to win over. And crucially also, he's really far behind a lot of these other candidates who are lining up in the money race.
Right.
Also, it's sort of not clear who his sort of like powerful allies in government are going to be.
Yeah. What else are you thinking, Mac?
I think this is a sign of life for the mayor. I mean, mayors always have low approval ratings, right? When I hear, what was the number again? 40?
So it's 34% who are in favor. And he's got a 44% group who says they look at him unfavorably.
Well, certainly an unfavorable situation. But, you know, over a couple of years ago, the mayor was polling, I think, near the single digits, according to some pollsters. So definitely a rise for the mayor. I think his foil to Trump as part of Operation Midway Blitz had a lot to do that. And I think, you know, there has been some quieting of the storm, at least internal issues inside his office. You know, some senses of stability, even though the legislative accomplishments haven't really racked up for the mayor. So, and I do think he has a viable path to reelection in some ways, just as the progressive likely to be in the race and his support in certain segments of the Black community, an important coalition that brought him into office in the first place.
That's right.
So overall favorability, these polls are a little hit or miss all over the place. It's hard to read too much into it, but I think he's still in the game.
Yeah, if you're a person who checks the numbers, I mean, this would drive me insane. But, you know, Mary, 34 is not six, like Alex said.
Right, right. I mean, 100% is, there's a big spectrum of things that can happen
in
there. Of course,
and you can't make everyone happy.
Right, right.
Yeah, and it's not just the voters who are viewing the mayor unfavorably. Alders are also expressing doubts. This week, they voiced concerns about the city's budget and the money that's being spent on an outside consulting firm. What should we know here, Alex?
That's right. And remember that last year, the city council essentially went rogue and passed its own version of the budget, replacing some really key revenue features that the mayor did not support. And so this was kind of a check back in saying, hey, are you actually the mayor's administration following through on that? And the answer, it seemed like, was to a degree, yes. They said that revenues and expenditures are tracking pretty closely to what they had passed in the budget, and so sort of cooling some of those fears that there might have to be mid-year layoffs. As far as the Ernst & Young contract that you mentioned, this was sort of a hubbub that was part of the budget discussion last year that the city brought on this private consultant, now known as EY, to try to find some places to cut, efficiencies, reforms, things like that. They laid out a bunch of those reforms in this report last year, and we learned earlier this week that they are now being retained, EY, to actually help implement some of these reforms. And so the city's budget director, Annette Guzman, was talking about this really excitedly and glowingly, and we're trying to really overhaul and update and change the culture around a lot of these systems and get really big savings and efficiencies. But of course, the problem is those kinds of big cultural shifts and overhauls can take years. They can take a really long time, and they can demand upfront costs. And in the meantime, we are gearing up for another budget season that is certainly going to have a deficit in the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more. And it's going to be even harder because this is going to be the election year budget. And so everyone wants to just like pass something that's quick and quiet and not talk about it. But is that going to be possible? Probably not.
Mary, let's steer the conversation over to a neighborhood west of City Hall, just over the Kennedy. I'm talking about the UIC campus. What are grad students there protesting about?
Yes. So the Graduate Workers Union has been on strike this week after bargaining for more than a year now with administrators at UIC. They seem to be pretty far apart on some key issues, mainly wages and health insurance. And I was at a rally earlier this week. They've continued to be on strike all week, and they have more bargaining coming up today. So we'll see what goes on with that. But on Tuesday when I was there, it seemed like the administration and the grad workers union was, they were quite far apart on these really key issues. So we'll see what continues to happen and how things go at the end of the school year for UIC.
Yeah, we got some days to go then, it sounds like, on this. But we did get some good economic news for college grads and for the city from IBM. What did the company announce?
Yeah, so IBM announced a delivery hub is going to be placed on the far south side. Just the south side. That'll bring jobs in cybersecurity, AI, data science. That's going to be at the planned Illinois Quantum and Microelectronics Park campus, which has been
highly
anticipated. Yes, $500 million in state funding. And they will also be partnering IBM well with city colleges to work out apprenticeship programs, commitment to hiring graduates from city colleges. And their goal really is to attract young local talent that will stay in the area and really just improve those fields locally that I mentioned.
Mac, there's an update in the case against the so-called Broadview 6, or is it the Broadview 4? I can't keep up, but remind us who these folks are and the charges against them.
Yeah, so these are local political candidates that were set to take the stand in the next landmark trial in the city related to the federal operation and the campaign to prosecute protesters to that operation. And it's led by, progressive Kat Abu-Ghazaleh, who has, become a very forefront progressive and online sources in the city. Three others, two charges against two other political candidates have since been dropped. But now felony charges against all of them have been dropped, Sasha. So that trial will not go on. Prosecutors said that they will instead pursue misdemeanor charges against Abu-Ghazaleh and three others. It relates to a September protest in which they appeared in video to block a federal vehicle as it entered the Broadview facility. So a thin case, and a lot of thin cases have been left on prosecutors, has led many people to think that these are frankly just scare tactics. And when it comes time to actually build the case in the court of law, they crumble upon inspection.
Well, let's hear from Kat Abu-Ghazaleh. She talked with Mary Dixon and Patrick Smith yesterday on WBEZ's Say More. This is what she had to say about all this.
These cases are not meant to find justice. They are meant to intimidate you into silence, into complicity. They're meant to punish you psychologically and financially for dissent.
So that echoes a lot of what you were just saying, Mac. And as you said, it's just misdemeanor charges now, right?
Yeah. Prosecutors say they will pursue misdemeanor charges. We don't know what those charges are, but we'll see when they come.
Now, findings from a state commission tasked with investigating the Chicago area immigration crackdown have been released. Governor Pritzker is now calling on local prosecutors to pursue criminal charges against ICE agents that the commission says used excessive force. The Cook County State's Attorney's Office said in a statement that it will review the evidence compiled by the group before bringing charges. Mac, I remember you spent a lot of time last fall, and we've talked about it numerous times. You covered Operation Midway Blitz. Tell me more about what you heard from protesters and residents about how that immigration crackdown really impacted them.
People want accountability, Sasha. Just because they're out of town doesn't mean the dust has settled on this situation. And we've seen the high-profile ousting of leaders of the Department of Homeland Security for their role in creating this operation. But a lot of the agents themselves continued to just be doing their jobs. Many of these people who interacted with Chicagoans on the street and led to some what they consider some of the most violent and traumatic moments of their lives still do not know who those agents who did that were. So we'll see. There has been a very limited, if I believe, no indictments of federal agents for actions they've done on the job related to immigration enforcement. Those are very hard charges to bring. And there's pushback, obviously, from the county prosecutor here about the threshold to make those types of cases. Mm-hmm. So it's a long road to accountability. We've seen major changes up top, but for the people in the streets actually, acting on those orders, we've seen very little accountability.
Yeah, I remember even just looking back at your body of work during that time, you know, at least one of your articles, the headlines cited many instances of violence and unlawful detainment.
Yeah, over 48 uses of chemical weapons against Chicagoans and civilians during the three-month operation.
All right. Well, in other news, today marks 60 days of war with Iran. Under the War Powers Resolution, that would mean that Congress must now authorize continued use of force. But House Speaker Mike Johnson said yesterday that there's no need for Congress to weigh in because it's not actually a war. Now, while that continues to be debated in D.C., the war is actually impacting us here at home in very different ways. Illinois this week saw the largest increase in gas prices since the war began. According to AAA, the average price for gas is now $4.66 a gallon, folks. You think people are starting to feel the impact of this? I mean, we've been talking about the rise for the last little while, but it's really starting to like take a toll at this point, I feel.
Yeah, not great.
Not
sure.
Great. Not great.
Yeah, I think, like you said, it was, you could tell it was coming. It was, you know, creeping up. Mm-hmm. And then this week, it seems like we saw a huge spike. And yeah, I mean, people are going to be paying for this at the gas pump for sure.
Willie Wilson, where are you?
Yeah,
come pay for
say.
A gas.
Oh, Willie Wilson. No. Yes.
What's time for Willie.
I mean, like, man. I put up the Batman signal. What I'm going to be keeping an eye on is whether this has like a tangible impact on transit ridership. I mean, this is right as
that's
the CTA
and
Metra are starting to dole out some of this new funding from the big bill that passed last year. We're starting to see a little bit more frequent and more reliable bus and train service. Are we now going to see that reflected in some of those numbers of people being like, gas is too expensive, I'm going to take the bus?
Yeah, I feel like you might be onto something there.
Part of the CTA redemption arc.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It just, for me, it always kind of comes down to like, I'm so reliant on my vehicle. And I think I need to sort of take a page out of the book you just tried to open there, Alex, because I'm of the, well, I have no choice. I just got to pay it.
And I'm running late.
And I cover my eyes as I pass the gas station. I just don't want to see the number. I just swipe the card and I'm like, oh God.
Right. Because what are you going to do about it? You can't go to a cheaper gas station because it's all expensive.
The one across the street is probably even more expensive. So
I have feelings about this. Especially, you know, I'm glad to see Chicago is taking a step forward of fixing our broken bridges. But for people commuting from the north side of the city over to the northwest side of the city, sometimes those rush hour traffics with the bridge closures can last over 40, 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. That plus the gas prices is just all kind of a recipe for disaster and frustration.
Get a bike, my advice.
Get a bike, yes. Mary, now you've been talking to local Iranian Americans and international students from Iran, right? Tell me more about how watching what's happening across the world is impacting them here.
Yes, I mean, there are so many impacts, especially for these students and professors that I've been speaking to. You know, some of them have grew up in Iran and now have family and friends that they're worried about. Others are planning to return to Iran after they graduate, and now those plans are in flux because they don't know if it'll be safe. They don't know if there will be jobs. They don't know what's going to unfold between now and graduation, and others are struggling with their visas, which is, you know,
was part of the Trump administration's visa pause. Iran was on the list of countries that wouldn't be reissuing visas. So they're having, you know, all sorts of problems that range from very very personal to, you know, really large scale, obviously dealing with, you know, being the target of war by the U.S. Mm-hmm. and Israel. So it's, yeah, and, you know, you're seeing impacts on campus, too. You know, people are talking a lot about, you know, where are the student activists that were so vocal a couple of years ago during the pro-Palestinian encampments. And there have been a lot of factors in the past couple of years that have kind of shifted how student activism looks.
Hmm. And Alex, the Illinois legislature is also weighing in on what's happening in the Middle East. There's this effort underway to repeal a 2015 law requiring Illinois to divest from companies that boycotted investment in Israel.
Right. It's a little bit confusing. Divest from the folks who divest.
Yes.
So it is, we're talking about the BDS, the Boycott, Divest, Sanction movement of people who or businesses that intentionally do not economically engage with the state of Israel. There was this bill passed by the Illinois legislature in 2015, basically in support of Israel, saying if you as a business do like boycott or divest from Israel or have that policy, we as the state of Illinois will not do business with you. And so we are seeing a bill to undo that, sponsored by State Rep Abdel Nasser Rashid, who is Palestinian, who has talked openly about the experience of his own family being, you know, terrorized in the West Bank by Israeli settlers.
Right.
And basically saying, look, regardless of what you think of this, we should not be wielding our, you know, economic authority as the state of Illinois to punish companies for their own viewpoints. And it has actually gathered a lot of support, this bill, in, I think, a sign of just the changing politics and culture around this. And that is made especially vivid by then State Senator Daniel Biss, who helped pass that when he was a state senator in 2015. Now he's the mayor of Evanston and on his way to mm-hmm. Congress. And he came out and said, actually, I would support this bill. I would vote to repeal it as a really, you know, now that the winds have shifted and
yes.
His belief on this has shifted, I guess, too.
So, Alex, you just finished up a very interesting deep dive. This was into Cook County's property tax troubles. So let me get this straight. Thousands are still waiting for bills and for refunds?
Yeah, this really is the latest chapter in the odyssey of the county trying to overhaul and change its property tax system to migrate onto a new software that is being done through this vendor called Tyler Technologies that is going office to office, tax office to tax office. And really for the last like 7 years, it has run into problem after problem after problem. And right now the problems are in the Cook County Treasurer's Office. The Treasurer, Maria Pappas, is responsible for mm-hmm. sending out all of the bills. And it has become, you will remember that property tax bills went out really late last year. They're typically supposed to go out in like July. They didn't go out until November last
right,
year, which caused
right.
all kinds of problems. But what A.D. Quigg, my colleague over at the Chicago Tribune, and I found was that still, as of all these months later, there were thousands of folks who still had not gotten their bills. And so they're working on this. They're working down this backlog. But it's this really painstaking process of like playing whack-a-mole. They fix one
blame
problem.
Blame technology.
Blame technology, blame the vendor, blame each other. It's this massive, you know, finger-pointing game where the treasurer's office is saying, like, this vendor is absolutely incompetent. They're not doing the work that they're supposed to be doing. They have no incentive to actually hurry up. And the vendor is basically saying, hey, we're trying as hard as we can, and it doesn't help that, like, mm-hmm. the treasurer is yelling at us. So they're just sort of pushing their way through. As much as they can. There are a lot of first installment bills from 2025. In other words, the bills that went out this spring that have not gone out yet. And so they're pushing their way through bit by bit. But the consequences of this are reverberating for a lot of real people who need to know
sure.
how much they owe on their house.
Absolutely. Well, you know who's not known for paying taxes? The mafia. Looking at you, Mac.
They collect.
Yes, yes. A former Chicago mobster has turned telling his story into a full-time career. What is Frank Calabrese Jr. up to these days?
So we came across Frank Calabrese Jr. on Cameo. He's selling Cameo videos.
And not Cameo.
You know, happy birthday. Please give your friend the $1,000 he owes him. Stuff like that. And Frank Calabrese was in the news 20 years ago for something very different. He was a FBI informant, and he actually wore a wire against his own father, who was a prominent Chicago outfit hitman, which led to a trial that brought down the two head bosses of the Chicago outfit in the first ever instance of a made man of the mafia in Chicago being convicted of a homicide. Mm. So Frank Calabrese got out from under his father's shadow and has turned telling his story in a new life into a full-time career. He speaks four times a day, Sasha. Think about that. You speak a lot, but telling your life story four times a day at a museum, 5 days a week.
That would be exhausting.
In Las Vegas, and he's selling the cameos and making appearances. He told me he did a pregame prep talk for the Washington Capitals ahead of a game against the Blackhawks. So
sounds like something straight out of The Sopranos.
Appearances everywhere. And, you know, as we've seen kind of the mafia really fade into the darkness in certain ways, given these high profile federal investigations, the legalization of many of their businesses, like gambling, we've had a few people who've become these quote unquote celebrity gangsters and have really stepped out of that without fear to tell their stories and the inner workings of the mafia. There's very few of them, and it seems like Frank is the guy for Chicago.
Mm. Another person who shared very different stories about life in Chicago died this week, Mac. Why don't you tell us about Pete Castanis, the creator of Vanished Chicagoland?
So you might not have heard Pete's name, but I'm sure everyone here has heard of his page, Vanished Chicagoland. He was known of going through the Chicago archives and finding old pictures of classic neon signs and businesses that have been long gone since. And he had a Facebook page to celebrate these businesses and locations around the city that had over a quarter of a million followers of Chicagoans just sharing stories like, hey, what happened to my ice cream place around the corner on 65th Street and whatever? And, you know, someone would respond and find it for them and find a picture and discuss memories down old time lane. So Pete, really, I'm just a great community person. He actually won a Civilian Historian Award from the Chicago History Museum a year back for all his work, which really became a life's work for him. He died at age 62 after a prolonged battle with cancer, but his page and his memories will live on, and another famous Chicago history page called Chicago History dedicated its work to Pete moving forward, which I thought was really sweet.
Good. Yeah, our thoughts are with his loved ones and the many people whose lives he touched. So the Vanished Chicagoland project will continue then.
I'm not so sure about that, but I know Chicago history will definitely continue in the name of Pete.
I hope they can find some way to keep that going. We're also sending our condolences to the family and friends of Chicago organizer Amisha Patel, who died this week after a 9-year battle with cancer. Now, Patel's being remembered by State Rep Delia Ramirez, who was a close friend, for her 3 decades of on-the-ground work here on things like affordable housing, quality education, and raising the minimum wage here in Chicago and Illinois. And longtime Chicago actor Matt DeCaro, who is known best for his role as a correctional officer in Prison Break and who is currently part of the Ma Rainey's Black Bottom cast at the Goodman Theater, he's also died. He was 70 years old. Now let's turn to something very different. For the second year in a row, Mary, the Cinco de Mayo parade in the largely Mexican neighborhood of Little Village, it's canceled. Why did organizers say it's canceled this time?
Yes, it is. So, like you said, for the second year in a row, same reasons, it's immigration concerns. I think the big takeaway here is they canceled it last year before Operation Midway Blitz, seeing what was going on around the country, seeing what the Trump administration was doing regarding immigrant communities. And this year, since the operation, those fears haven't really dissipated all that much. I mean, it's much quieter. We discussed this earlier about, you know, kind of the lingering effects, the ripple effects of Operation Midway Blitz last fall. And this is a perfect example of immigrant communities are still nervous. They're still thinking about what could happen when a large number of them gather.
Right.
And organizers canceled the parade and associated festivities.
Now, Mac, the city's last Black-owned bowling alley has closed its doors. Tell us about Skyway Lanes.
This is a tough one, Sasha. So Skyway Lanes has been in the Jeffrey Manor on the far south side neighborhood since the 1950s. And they sounded an alarm about a year ago that they were in trouble. It's a very large sprawling facility with aging conditions. They lost a number of bowling leagues after the pandemic, which is really the backbone of the bowling business. But neighborhoods and neighbors and bowlers across the country rallied around them and raised over $25,000 in an effort to save the bowling alley.
Yes, I remember that.
That kept them afloat for a full final year. So I like to think of it as maybe just enough to throw one more birthday party, right, at the bowling alley.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, time caught up to just this litany of issues and cost problems. And the bowling alley closed for good last week. And they celebrated on Sunday with $2 bowling games. I was
nice.
There and I rolled a 161
yes.
at Skyway, which is, I think,
great.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, a lot of people, they just had really bittersweet feelings. You know, back in the sports heyday, there was over 110 bowling alleys, actually, in the city of Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And now there's under 10 of them, and a lot of reasons to
yeah,
deal with that.
Aren't
yeah,
there mm-hmm. That's right. That's sad.
Yeah. That's a big drop.
Yeah,
110 to 10?
Yeah, there's multiple reasons for this. I don't know how much time I have to talk about this, but...
You can talk.
But, you know, less bowling leagues, especially as the younger generation dives deeper into their phones, we're having less social gatherings, and, you know, these businesses are on very large city properties that have high taxes and are often worth more as demolition condo building projects than they are as the bowling businesses inside of them. So it really takes a special type of hands-on person to make a bowling alley work. The second generation owners of Skyway were getting a bit older and seeing the writing on the wall. But it's really unfortunate in a community like this, Sasha, that's seen, you know, declining populations, especially in a lot of Black communities
yes.
in the city. And with that, you know, the death of really third spaces where you throw your birthday party, you have your graduation party, you have your repasses. There isn't really few spaces like that remaining. So,
right.
Yeah. And that's really the glue of communities. That's what keeps communities together.
Yeah. You bring up a great point. I'm just really happy for what you mentioned, that they had what sounds like a really good send off.
Yeah, absolutely. Well attended.
You know what else we're going to do as far as send-offs? I think we're going to have to do one for you, Mac, because we're saying goodbye to you. We won't have you moving forward on our weekly news recap anymore, but we are super excited for where you are headed. You're going to the Big Apple.
Yes, I am.
You're going to be working with the New York Times.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm starting a fellowship. Oh, thank you so
Congratulations.
Much.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you for referring me a funeral today. Really
not a funeral. We're happy.
$2 bowling.
we will smile at some point, but we're happy.
We'll never thank forget you, so much. You. We'll carry on your memory.
Your memory.
I'll be in New York City for at least a year in the New York Times fellowship writing breaking news and general
Sweet.
Assignments. So kind of like my job now at Block Club. I'm excited to represent all of us out there.
You're going to do all that in the Big Apple. Listen, when you get over there, please do not forget your many friends back here in Chicago.
I want to thank your crew too, Sasha, for the many times of you had me. Andrea, Micah, this guy with the glasses.
Ethan, our engineer.
Ethan, love you, Ethan, too. The really just amazing people here, great energy. This really brightens my day, so thank you for having me so much.
The guy
many
with
times.
The glasses really brightens his
day. He's smiling, you can't see it right now.
Well, listen, I know you're going to miss covering your classic Block Club stories, like that Wrigley Field rat from last week.
Yeah.
Any others that you can think of real quick that you know are just going to stay with you from your time at Block Club Chicago?
Well, I'll definitely think about you know, the breaking news stories, the investigations I've done into you know, CTA public transit and the leaders of the agency not using public transit.
Mm-hmm.
I'll think about the Uber stories I wrote that led to refunds of over $1 million for local customers. But I'll think about the times I covered the, you know, the DNC and the immigration crackdown and
yes.
the migrant busting. I think immigration is really the issue of our time in many ways. But I think what I'll think about most is just the stories about one-of-a-kind Chicagoans I wrote, let it be a deep dish pizza server who also doubled as a local matchmaker, or
oh yes,
the last courtroom sketch artist in Cook County, or the guy who jumps into the lake every single day. So
yeah.
I think, you know, something that's really beautiful about our city, Sasha, is that there's just so many different ways to live a life here, and there's no one right way to do it. But the more time I've spent with so many unique people, the more I learn about how I want to live my own. So
yeah,
just really amazing the many people I've met here.
You've had some of the best assignments And I can see you getting emotional.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Chicago's going to miss you, Mac, but I think you're going to do some amazing things in New York. I don't know if New York's ready for you.
Oh, yeah. You can find some weird New Yorkers, I bet. Yeah. Some matchmaking pizza.
It's going to be
slinging.
Some quirky stuff.
Yeah.
I'll be looking out. I'll be checking out the New York Times to see what you're up to.
No, thank you for having me, guys.
Best of luck. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Mary Norkel of the Chicago Sun-Times, Block Clubs, Mac Lederman, and Alex Nitkin of the Better Government Association. Have a good weekend, folks.
Thanks.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guthman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.